Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There you are, running your insurance company, minding your own business, when the President of the United States says, hey, all that work you did on healthcare the past 3 years? Yeah, not so fast. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 15th of November. Great to have you with us. At the White House today, well, healthcare, what else? President Obama sat down with CEOs of big insurance companies this afternoon for a round of, and this is his word, brainstorming. Because as you know, the president now wants to let insurance companies keep going with the approximately 4 million individual policies they have spent the past few weeks canceling. That sounds, in principle, easy enough. In reality, though, if you're an insurance company, come on. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains.
Pretend you're an insurance company.
Well, I was CEO of an insurance company, and I wouldn't be happy.
J.B. Silvers is professor of health finance at Case Western. Insurance companies are unhappy because all the calculations they made about how to price policies have changed.
It's a challenge. No question, it's a big challenge for them.
Here's why. Obamacare made you cancel a bunch of cheap policies because they were cheap and bare bones. But you expected those people to go buy new, better, more expensive policies and make you more money. But who are these people?
These are policies that, for the most part, were probably sold to pretty healthy individuals.
This is Monica Lindeen, Insurance Commissioner of Montana. So the healthy people keep paying very little on the old policies, but all the sick people flock to the better policies on the healthcare exchanges. Guess what happens to Obamacare?
So in reality, you may have a sicker pool, which then is going to raise rates on all those folks in 2015.
Plus, you don't know who'll actually keep the old policy, says Vivian Ho, professor of health economics at Rice University.
How do I figure out what premium to charge these customers? Because I just don't know which of them are going to stay with me and then which of them are going to leave.
Not to mention the logistical and regulatory challenge of having two different types of customers with two different sets of rules. In the end, insurance companies don't have to extend the policies, even though they can, and many observers predict they won't. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, here we go. The past 5 days wrapped up in 4 minutes of live radio, maybe four and a half, I don't know. A segment we call our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. For that, we've got John Carney from CNBC in our New York studios and Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government. She is down in Washington, D.C. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
So let's start, Neela, I guess, with you and the doings in Washington yesterday. Janet Yellen, confirmation hearings to be the new chairwoman of the Federal Reserve. Nothing surprising, right?
Nothing surprising, but there was a lot of attention paid on regulation. And I think that's interesting because well after the Fed stops its stimulus, there's going to be this new question of the Federal Reserve's new mandate to do systemic risk regulation, more regulation than ever before provided by the Dodd-Frank Act. And while the markets may think that Yellen is a dove when it comes to stimulus, she is definitely a hawk when it comes to regulation.
Which we had David Gurr explaining to us yesterday. John Carney, to you, I want to ask you the regulation question in a minute, but anything surprising to you out of this hearing?
How gentle it was. I mean, there was a lot of talk beforehand that Yellen might, you know, come under serious fire. I don't think that happened at all. She was given a very respectful hearing, and it was nice actually to see Washington, D.C. behave itself.
But she did her best, did she not, Neela? She did her best effort at not saying anything in the fine tradition of Fed chair people everywhere.
And that's why she will be a great Fed chairman.
Right.
But even still, she said enough to support a really big uptick in the stock market. So, it's a fine line between saying little and still boistering the stock market.
Yeah. Have you been reading my list of questions? Because we're going there in a minute. But, John, I do want to get you to weigh in this regulation thing. After the Fed tapers, winds down its big bond buying program, do you think that they're going to get serious about regulation?
I do. I think Janet Yellen's actually the perfect person to do that. She will be the very first Fed chair who comes in with this new regulatory mandate with where the Fed is basically the boss of the banking sector. We never really had anything like this in place before, and she's going to set the tone for the future. And as Neela said, she is a hawk when it comes to regulations. She wants to make sure that this is going to be her legacy eventually. It's not going to be the taper. It's not going to be QE. It's going to be regulation of the banking sector.
That's an interesting point. All right, Neela, since you brought it up, the stock market, with the standard caveat that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is not the economy and the economy is not the Dow, I'm obliged to point out that there are record highs falling all over the place on Wall Street. The Dow today at 15,961. Here you go. It's a one-word question. Why?
Why? That's a really
tough,
hard
huh? Well, those one-word questions are tricky, aren't they?
But if you ask Janet Yellen, if you listen to her hearing, it's not because of bubbles. And that's right. What's going to make some people a bit nervous, because there does look to be some bubbly behavior in the stock market. Mm-hmm. So, you know, irrational exuberance comes to mind, but it seems to be that the stock market is very disconnected from the labor market right now.
As it has been for years. John, yesterday we talked about it on the program, even though I wasn't here. Snapchat turning down $3 billion. Can you say bubble, yo?
It is completely mind-blowing, insane. I'm not worried so much about a bubble in the actual stock market, but in the prices being paid for some of these startups, $1 billion for Instagram, turning down $3 billion. The founder and CEO of this company is 23. When a 23-year-old walks away from $3 billion, that's trouble. There's a bubble.
What is the disconnect, John? Why do you think the market is so disconnected from the rest of the economy?
I think that we have serious structural problems when it comes to employment that we haven't quite figured out why that's there. Companies are making record profits and, you know, and the stock market is going up and up, but it's not being strongly reflected in the labor markets. Yeah. And I don't think anybody's solved that puzzle yet.
That's the both of you have come to the labor market as the big problem, which we all know it is. All right, we're done. John Carney at CNBC and Neela Richardson at Bloomberg Government. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai. Have a great weekend.
All right, you too. On Wall Street today, up, as I said, we will have the details when we do the numbers. Saw this in the New York Times today and the Wall Street Journal, I might add. Both papers say the CIA has been digging into data on money transfers, like the ones you send through Western Union. There are, of course, a boatload of questions. Here's that one-word question again. Why? Number two, whose transfers are they looking at? And just how do you tell the difference between a $100 remittance, that is money somebody sends back to their family back home, and a $100 payment to, say, a militant group? We asked Marketplace's David Gura to find the answer.
I wondered if there are mechanisms that flag money transfers to certain countries.
There are.
Compliance expert Michael Dawson was a deputy assistant secretary in the Treasury Department.
But it is very difficult to flag an individual transaction and determine with certainty that it's to an illicit terrorist group.
It always helps to have a target, Dawson says, someone you know is a criminal or a terrorist. If you're casting a wide net,
then the problem becomes a lot more difficult.
In the last fiscal year, one money transfer company, Western Union, processed more than 230 million transactions, altogether worth almost $80 billion. And it's not enough to know that money is going to, say, Afghanistan or Pakistan, according to Timothy Edgar, who used to be a lawyer at the White House.
You need to know additional information to say, okay, this transaction has some link to terrorism, and it's worth looking into more closely.
That information could be patterns of behavior tied together with other intelligence. But all that is balanced against privacy laws. Plus, a shrewd criminal or terrorist could use more than one company to transfer money. And there are other tricks.
Maybe you're not actually sending it directly to the bad guys.
Donald Daniel used to work for the National Intelligence Council.
You're sending it to somebody else who lives in a third country.
Who can get that payment to its final destination without raising that red flag. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
A nearly 10-year lawsuit against Google has come to an end. A federal district judge says the company's huge book scanning project, known appropriately as Google Books, does not violate copyright laws. Authors of books that have been digitized don't like that much. They say Google is unfairly profiting from their work. But Google isn't the only winner in this case, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the Education Desk at WYPR.
Robert Darnton runs the library at Harvard, one of the first universities to team up with Google to digitize its books. He says the ruling is a win for research.
When I heard it, I jumped for joy.
Darnton says Google's repository of more than 20 million books makes it possible to search billions of words to track language and ideas over time. It's known as text mining. And he says it helps researchers stumble on books they otherwise wouldn't know about. Users can view snippets of text, and Google tells them where they can buy or borrow the whole thing.
I believe that this will benefit the very authors who are suing.
True, Google can make money by selling those books itself or by linking to sites like Amazon. But Forrester research analyst James McQuivey says that's not where the real money is.
Really, what Google cares about is adding up all the ways that you can spend your time on Google or Chrome or YouTube or Android.
And selling that information to advertisers. Google stopped showing ads on Google Books itself a few years ago as part of a settlement with publishers. And that's one reason the judge ruled that Google's book copying constituted fair use. The public good outweighed his concerns about commercial gain. Pam Samuelson teaches law at UC Berkeley. She says Google's whole business model is built on fair use of other people's content.
What do all search engines do? They make copies of things that they can get their hands on and index those in order to make efficient searches possible.
The Authors Guild says it will appeal. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The Chinese government has done what American journalists here will recognize as a classic 5 o'clock on a Friday night news dump. Xinhua, the official news agency over there, published a major set of policy reforms late last night, Beijing time, that are designed to rejigger the Chinese economy over the coming decades. It includes, and this has been the headline item, further relaxing of the one-child policy. Rob Schmitz is our man in Shanghai. Hey, Rob.
How you doing, Kai?
Good. I guess the first question on this policy is why the change?
I think the government is worried that the economic model that it's been depending on for the last 10, 20 years is starting to wear out. China's leaders are looking to transition to an economy driven by people buying things rather than by the state building things.
Is this about China not having enough workers? Do they want more babies, more people?
I think part of the one-child policy change has to do with making sure that people feel good about living in China, especially during a point where I think in what we're going to see in the next 2 or 3 years, slower growth. Honestly, China is in a period of transition. We're going to see growth that people aren't used to. And the one-child policy, which has never been popular in China, is something that everyone has always wanted for the government to loosen up on.
When you take your boys to the local playground, is the one-child policy something people talk about, or is it just a fact of life and let's move on?
It's a fact of life. People don't usually talk about it unless, as a foreigner, they see that I'm at the playground with my two sons.
Right.
And they say, oh, in your America, you can have more than one child. And some people still, they haven't been outside of China, so they don't know that. And I say, yes, you know, we can have as many as we want. A lot of times that gives them pause for thought. They think, wow.
There is a social safety net aspect of this thing, too, right? Because now what you have is a whole bunch of single Chinese kids taking care of two parents and conceivably
right.
four grandparents. And there's not a big pension system over there. So that's part of what's going on.
Exactly. And, you know, in China, as you said, when people grow older, they usually live with their adult children and they'll usually take the place of being parents. They'll take care of their grandchildren. If they've lived and worked much of their lives in the place where they grew up, they're eligible for a modest pension. But this doesn't apply to many Chinese these days because so many have moved away from where they're legally registered to live. So depending on your children to take care of you is common. And for those urban-only children, this puts a lot of pressure on them.
One other thing, Rob, I wanted to ask you about. There was a part of this document that came out from the central government in Beijing today talking about how in some parts of the country, they will put less emphasis on economic development and more emphasis on environmental protection. Seems to be a big deal.
This is something that the leaders of China have now finally understood could potentially be a social stability issue. And for the party, for the Communist Party of China, social stability is number one on their list of things that can go very, very bad for them and basically means an end to their rule. Because they have a more educated population, the leaders need to be more accountable. And so I think they put that in there, I think, to appease a lot of people. I'd like to see what they mean by that. And I guess we'll see in the next, next 5-10 years.
Rob Schmitz in Shanghai for us. Rob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
Coming up, the changing face of fine dining.
We have people eating insects, people eating grass, people eating leaves, people eating hay, some people eating horse.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 85 points today, 0.5%, closed within 40 points of 16,000. It was, as I said to John and Neela, 15,961. The NASDAQ picked up 13 points, 0.3%, finished at 3,985. The S&P 500 made it a trifecta, up 7 points, more than 0.3%. Ended this Friday at 1798. For the week gone by, the Dow ended things up 1.3%. The tech-heavy NASDAQ gained 1.7%. The S&P 500 added 1.6% today. Pandora Media was humming a happy, algorithmically generated tune today. The digital radio pioneer jigged up 7%. That after analysts predicted good advertising growth and noted that Apple's iTunes radio hasn't quite gained a whole lot of traction. Sirius XM also danced up today 3% there, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. Feminist and founder of Ms. Magazine, Gloria Steinem, speaks to the National Press Club. And on November 18, 1959, the epic drama Ben-Hur, with its famous chariot race, premiered in New York City. It won 11 Academy Awards. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. While the White House tries to find its way through the minefield that the Affordable Care Act has become, over in London, the British National Health Service is having problems of its own, of a different kind as well. It's too popular with people who aren't supposed to be able to use it. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
Big Ben and the Gothic splendor of the Houses of Parliament attract tourists from all over the world. Even now, in November, there are scores of them clicking away with their cameras in Parliament Square. Meanwhile, inside the House of Commons, lawmakers are focusing on a less welcome group of foreign visitors.
Order, order. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Immigration Bill.
This committee, working on a draft immigration law, has been hearing evidence about people who come to Britain solely to rip off its public health service, the NHS.
I know of an American who had 2 bone marrow transplants in hospital for 2 months and went away again.
Surgeon Myrian Thomas, he says he believes that 5% of his patients are foreigners who are not entitled to the free healthcare they receive. Jacqueline Bishop, a hospital official, says she frequently comes across health tourists.
You've got those that come through via the loopholes and will come over here to study and bring their family for their fertility treatment and maternity care, liver transplants, and that type of thing.
That type of health care for unentitled foreign visitors may, according to a government study, cost the British taxpayer up to $500 million a year.
I do believe that's a considerable underestimate. It is quite clear that that number is too small.
Robert Oxley of the Taxpayers Alliance feels that due to slack controls and a free and easy ethos, the NHS has become a bit of a free-for-all.
It does come down to this fact that many people have always seen the NHS as free, despite that it has never been free. It has been free at the point of use. It has always been paid for by general taxation.
To curb what it sees as an abuse of the NHS, the government has just unveiled a plan in the British media.
Up to £500 million could be recovered for the NHS every year from overseas visitors and migrants who use the health service.
Among the proposals, much tighter checks on patient eligibility and an annual levy of up to $300 for foreign students or temporary migrants who want to access public health care. But the plan is meeting resistance from within the NHS. Dr. Lawrence Buckman, a family physician in North London.
This would mostly fall on our receptionists to establish whether someone was or was not entitled. Our receptionists are not border police, do not have the time or the inclination to become border police, nor do we wish to be tax collectors for the government.
Some doctors dispute that health tourism is a major problem. This East London clinic, run by an international charity, Doctors of the World, helps foreign patients. There are many coming here who've been refused treatment by the NHS. The clinic's Dr. Paquita de Zulueta describes the crackdown as unnecessary and unethical.
It completely contravenes all professional ethics to start discriminating and not treating the patient who is in clinical need.
The British government is pressing ahead, however. It says the NHS is the national, not the international health service. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Dinner time in this country isn't what it used to be, and I'm not talking about families not taking time to sit together at the kitchen table like they used to either. People are just eating interesting things. New Yorker magazine staff writer Dana Goodyear has spent the past couple of years following foodies from table to table, trying to understand the implications of what we eat. Her new book about that adventure is called Anything That Moves. Dana, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
So I'm going to start at the end, actually, of this book, and I'm going to have you read the very last paragraph. And you are, I will provide the context. You are eating a duck egg, a Filipino delicacy called balut.
Cool.
In the middle of that last paragraph there.
Just as I was congratulating myself, thinking it was a mental game and I had won, something terrifying happened. From a deeper place than my taste buds, pushovers tricked by a lick of chicken soup, rebellion. I felt a shift in my upper stomach, a violent bubbling, and the beginnings of a catastrophe.
Okay, that's basically this whole book, man. People going out and eating weird stuff.
The book began with that very simple observation that going out to a fancy dinner had become a confrontation with the question of what is food?
Yeah. And what food is now almost anything.
It has changed dramatically in recent years. There's been an incredible broadening of what Americans are willing to accept as edible. We have people eating insects, people eating grass, people eating leaves, people eating hay, some people eating horse. And a lot of these foods are very controversial and have built-in taboos that Americans are wrestling with.
Here's the thing, though, and I get that, and I like to adventurously eat or eat adventurously as much as the next guy, but you have a passage in here where you went to some ethnic restaurant, I think it was Asian, I don't know, where you're having like a pig's ear, I guess, and it had been flattened and put in its own aspic or whatever it was. And you're right, very descriptively, and it just does not sound appetizing.
People often ask me, what's the strangest thing I've ever eaten? Mm-hmm. And I put the Mexican caviar up there. I put the frog fallopian tubes up there.
Wow. How do you get those? They must be so small. But anyway.
That's none of my concern.
That's a whole different thing.
And truly, the strangest thing that I tried was a cup of coffee brewed with beans that had been digested.
Oh, yeah.
And excreted by
these cats,
by
right?
These cats.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
these Sumatran civets.
Right,
and
right.
The beans cost $1,000 a pound. It was a $90 pour.
Was it good?
Do you like the taste of apple pie?
I do, very much.
There was sort of that caramelly, rich, burnt,
wow,
sugary flavor. But this epitomized something that I found really interesting in the course of researching this book, which is the way in which the high and the low have converged.
elite dining in America now is being substantially reshaped by the foods of poverty or the foods of desperation.
Which is fascinating, but it leads to this question. Are we, as the richest society on earth, doing damage? I mean, think about quinoa. We are now eating it by the truckful, and the Bolivian farmers for whom it's a subsistence staple can't afford it anymore.
There is no doubt that our appetites are disruptive.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think is really interesting and terrifying is that even as the American food movement is discovering resourceful ways of eating from cultures that have long practiced them, Asia is discovering the American 20th century way of eating. You know, China just bought Smithfield.
The pork people, yeah.
Exactly. So the resource-intensive, environmentally destructive way of getting food that we perfected in the 20th century, we're exporting now, even as this forward flank is starting to say, uh-oh, we better start thinking about eating bugs because things don't look too good from where we're sitting.
Dana Goodyear is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. Her most recent book is called Anything That Moves. It's a good one. Check it out. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which a small slice of corporate America strikes a blow for mom apple pie and the sanctity of a day off on Thanksgiving Day. I read in the Huffington Post that Costco and Nordstrom and BJ's Wholesale Club, among others, are going to do the right thing and be closed, refusing to give in to the Black Friday shopping insanity that has Walmart and Target and others actually being open on Thanksgiving Day itself. Amen to that. Of course, Lizzie O'Leary is going to be here doing my job. So easy for me to say, I suppose. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Friday. Today, the Dow up 85 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ picked up 13 points, 1/3 of 1%. The S&P 500 up 7 points. That is also 1/3 of 1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The show is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.